This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 135 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here, and we're talking, Andrew, about the trailblazers, the groundbreaking cars.
Yeah.
The cars that have created or defined their sectors. I mean, there are a few really significant, really important cars that have done exactly that. I think in this episode, we might also bust a few myths.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah,
because so many of these cars have all the credit, have taken the credit for being the cars that created their categories. And actually, if you go back and you look, very few of them did. Very few of them.
So
you think,
few.
Oh yeah, that's the car that, you know, that was the world's first whatever. Mm. Usually wasn't. Usually wasn't. It's like the sort of, you know, people think that, you know, the Boeing 707 was the world's first commercial jetliner and transformed the face of global aviation. But, you know, they kind of forget the valiant, doomed Comet, which the British did in the 1950s. And Boeing just sat there, learned all the lessons, and then did it properly. And there are so many examples in the car world of someone come along with this really cracking idea. But just not getting it right, or not having the resources to get it the exposure it needs, and, you know, or whatever. And then someone comes along and thinks, oh, that's not a bad idea. Well, we'll do that and we'll do it properly. And, you know, someone else does all the work and they take all the credit.
And often the very first example of a particular breed is an obscure car, isn't it?
That exactly.
Lots of people won't have heard of,
yeah.
But it did get there first. So that's the ones that have created a sector. What about the ones that have defined a sector? I mean, that's something different, isn't it? You don't have to be the first to, like an S-Class, for instance, to define that sector. That's more about longevity, isn't it?
That's more about doing it better than anyone else, yeah. But the thing is that if you are the one that is viewed to have started the sector, you know, because, I mean, those cars, well, let's just take the Golf GTI as the most obvious example.
Yeah.
Not the first hot hatch by a very, very long shot,
no.
Which I'm sure we'll come to in a minute. But, you know, because it was the one which, you know, captured the moment, you just get such a head start, because by the time everyone else has gone, shit, we better do something about this and come up with something which probably isn't as good. And then, you know, it takes time for wheels to turn and, you know, momentum to gather. And, you know, and all the time, Volkswagen's just going golf. Usually those are the cars that, I mean, something like an S-Class is a bit different because, you know, the four-door saloons have been around for as long as there have been cars. So, I mean, it kind of was the sector to begin with. So there wasn't really a sector to create, because that's what cars always were. Mm. I mean, certainly going back 100 or more years. But these other sectors, you know, sectors which people literally just hadn't heard of before they turned up, I think if you are perceived to be first to it, certainly if you are the one who, you know, instead of inventing it, produces the innovation that makes it successful, then you have such a head start over everybody else. I think that, well, maybe I'll be proven wrong. Maybe during the course of this podcast, we'll see examples of cars that weren't first, but still came to define their sectors. And now when you think of that sector, you think of that car before anything else. It'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, that's a good point, though, about technology pioneering a particular technology that allows a certain type of car to flourish.
Yeah.
That's a really important point. And, you know, we've got the Mini on our list, the original Mini. And there are plenty of examples there of defining something, some kind of innovating, pioneering some kind of technology or way of doing things that allows that type of car to become a bigger thing. I don't know really where we start, but we've got a whole bunch of them here. Should we do
the Golf, seeing as we've already mentioned it?
Yeah, Golf GTI. So very often the Golf GTI is declared the original hot hatch, isn't it?
Yeah.
And actually, what do we think is the original? The one that I've stumbled upon is the 1973 Simca 1100 Ti. We like the letters Ti around here.
We do.
And that was a hot-ish, hot hatch. It was a hatchback.
No,
a performance
by
hot
the
hatch.
Standards of nearly, goodness me, nearly 50 years ago. It did 100 miles an hour. You know, it had a tuned engine, I think 60 to 80 horsepower. It had a hatchback. That's the other thing to mention. You know, things just ruled themselves out. I mean, we'd all be talking about, you know, the original Mini Cooper as being the original hatchback if it had a hatchback.
Are we just into semantics now?
Well, it's a very good matter. Point. I mean, I always thought, you know, that Alfa Suds were, you know, hot hatchbacks. I mean, years before, I think the Sud came out in 1971, but it didn't get a hatch until about 1982. So, you know, in that definition of hot hatchbacks, it doesn't count.
Yeah.
So if it does count, if we're saying, oh, it's just semantics, you know, it's just a kind of style of car rather than a particular configuration, then it does count. But even before the Simca, there was, in 1971, there was the, what was it called? I've got it written down here. The Auto Bianchi A112 Arbath.
Of course, yeah.
Of course.
Well, there we go, yeah.
So, you know, that was 1971, and that had, I think, Fiat 127 running gear in it, but it had, you know, it had been tweaked up. I think it went from about, I mean, it wasn't massively powerful. I think it went from about, you know, 45 to 55 horsepower, but nevertheless, it was a hatchback, and it was a high-performance version of that. And unless we're putting, you know, limits on it and saying that you don't qualify unless you've got a certain amount of horsepower, which I don't think we'd want to do, then, you know, it may not be a car that anybody's heard of, but it's still a hot hatchback, and it was still knocking about, you know, 4 or 5 years before the Golf.
So the Golf, probably, does it get the credit because, well, A, it's been in production non-stop since 1976, so it has that longevity. It's also...
But why does it have that longevity? That's the question.
Well,
and why did the
it
Simca...
It is, indeed.
The answer to that is because it was just so bloody good. It just... You know, again, sadly, I'm old enough to kind of remember the early days of the Golf GTI. It was just so, because it was mainstream, it wasn't a sort of quirky little thing with a name like Simca or Auto Bianchi.
Well, that's a big part of it, isn't it? This is Volkswagen.
Yeah, exactly. This is Volkswagen. But also, they just did it so bloody well. I had a 1981 1.8, so one of the later Mark 1 Golf GTIs. And I can remember I lived in a street with a bunch of mates in a house, and I can remember one morning, we're all going off to whatever it was we were doing, and the weather had been absolutely terrible, and the snow was, you know, deep, and it was absolutely freezing. And there they were, you know, trying to, you know, prime their chokes and their carburetors and turning the car, go chug, 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 and they wouldn't start. And I literally just leant in, I stood on the street, leant in so smug, put the key in the ignition, turned it, and that lovely fuel-injected engine just went, boop, as if it had just been, you know, the warmest day in the world. It was, and it just worked. And they were so well built. They were so durable. So it was, you know, the idea of having a car that was that practical, but which was also such amazing fun to drive. It just hadn't been done before in any format. Because we think of, you know, Porsche 911, but they weren't that practical. You can't really get anyone in the back of one of those things. But here was a car which was a genuine family car, with space and a boot and, you know, rear seats that you could use, and And yet it would do like 110 miles an hour, which, you know, in the late 1970s was the sort of speed that you'd need, you know, a proper sports car to do, or a big saloon or something. And here was this reasonably affordable, beautifully built, you know, good looking, effective, practical German. It just ticked every box. Yeah. It just did what had done before, what had been done before, but just so wildly better that it basically just blotted it all out. It just became such an enormous presence that people just forgot. Do you remember there was the Renault 5 Gordini, which came before that? Beautiful car, with those lovely, you know, three-star wheels and everything else. Well, you know, I mean, I suppose that led to the Renault 5 GT Turbo and Clears and that sort of thing. You know, that predated the Golf GTI, but we don't think of that as being the third because it just didn't do the job as well. So I think that's what it's about.
So actually, to have a legacy, a car doesn't need to be the first. It doesn't need to be the very first. It needs to be the first that nails,
yes,
that nails the concept, yeah, doesn't it? It needs to be
actually,
the first to get it right.
And actually, if you are first, whether you're an Auto Bianchi or de Havilland making the Comet, the chances are you're not going to get it right because you're the first. Yeah. And there will be stuff, because you're blazing a trail, there'll be stuff you haven't come across before. And you either won't realise it, like tragically, de Havilland didn't realise with the Comet that you get stress fractures because it had square windows. Even they've got an airplane these days. I'm sorry, I'm going slightly at a tangent, but all aircraft have oval windows. And the Comet is the reason for that. It had square windows. And they didn't realise that if you have a square window, in the corners of the square, you create stress areas. And if you flex an airframe over tens of thousands of miles or journeys or whatever, you get little stress cracks literally in the corners of these windows. And that's what suddenly caused them to depressurise and fall out of the sky. They didn't know that at the time. But by the time Boeing did the 707, they did know it. Now, obviously, in the car world, there aren't, you know, the consequences are rarely that that terrible or serious. But, you know, there will be all sorts of things that, you know, in any class of car, that's, you know, a company like, you know, like Volkswagen or whoever can just look at it and think, oh, that's really interesting. But why did they do it that way? Wouldn't it be better if we did it this way? But you can only do that if someone else has had a go first.
So actually, in many cases, being second is a huge advantage.
Yes, absolutely.
Forget first mover advantage. You want to be second. But I wonder if we've got examples of... Actually, we will have examples of the first being the one that endured. There are examples of those, and I'm sure we'll come onto them. So we've done the hot hatch, and the Golf GTI was not the first hot hatch. But what was the first true people's car? How far back do we have to go?
What do you mean by people's car?
So what mobilised the masses more than anything? And I don't know if the Model T
Ford. Well, in America it did.
Was that the masses or was that a middle class car? So workers' car, you know, like a 2CV.
Well, I mean, over here, the Austin 7, certainly, in the mid-1920s. I mean, that came along. And again, you know, there were plenty of cars that you could buy even then which had that configuration, but none which worked quite so well, none which was quite so affordable. And also, you know, it looked really cute, and you know, and they just worked, and they just captured the moment, and you know, they like cashed in forever after. So I guess over here, I don't know about the Model T. I don't know enough. I mean, it was in production for an absolutely enormous period of time. And it probably wasn't when it first came out a sort of true car of the people. I don't know, but I think. But over time, as it got older, and they got into the economies of scale, and they made millions, and they realised just what they were onto. I suspect it probably did. And he's going to have a look.
Okay, so well, Austin 7—that's a good shout, particularly for the UK. But there were others, weren't there? 2CV, even the Beetle, but that's much later on.
Exactly.
Okay, let's think about the Land Rover, original Land Rover.
Yeah.
Long before it was the Series 1, when it was just the Land Rover.
Yeah.
But did that start the 4x4 sector, the rugged 4x4 market, or was it the Willys Jeep that got there first?
Well, the Jeep was there first. I mean, the Jeep came out. I mean, the thing about the Jeep and the Land Rover is neither of them were what turned into what they were ever intended to be originally. So the Willys Jeep, obviously, was a purely military vehicle, first produced in 1941 for military purposes. But it created this sub-brand, Jeep. I've just been on a Zoom call with Jeep, talking about its first ever all-electric product, the Avenger, which is going to go on sale in the UK next summer. And I think the phrase is, it's been on a bit of a journey in that time. So then, yeah, that car certainly wasn't what, you know, that they intended it to be. And the Land Rover, I mean, the Land Rover is, what is so amazing about the Land Rover is it was a stopgap. They saw this and they thought, all right, there's a real opportunity to do a farmer's car, really, but a car which could be used for various other purposes. And we're going to have a big, long think about that. But in the meantime, why don't we just knock something out really, really cheaply so we'll have a presence in the market? I mean, that's why, you know, it doesn't have, you know, why all its panels are straight, because there wasn't, it wasn't going to be around long enough to make it worthwhile to tooling up, you know, expensive machines that could do curves and that sort of thing. It was made out of aluminium, not because it was lighter or anything else, but after the war, that's what was most plentiful. You know, all those military machines being scrapped, aluminium was everywhere and steel was scarce. And it was just a stopgap. And so they just, you know, thought, well, we'll just stick that on the market and then we'll do the proper car.
do you, off the top of your head, was the Willys Jeep or the Jeep made commercially available before the Land Rover turned up?
Was.
Or was it purely?
Yeah, I think it was.
So the Jeep probably does deserve the credit there.
Yeah.
For being the first in that sector.
Yeah. Yes.
But see, yeah, the Land Rover, it's such an interesting story. We did actually record a podcast specifically about the Land Rover a while ago, didn't we?
Looking
at the history of that car.
It wasn't our first podcast, was it?
No, we did it relatively recently.
Yeah.
We did do it relatively recently. So while we're on it, while we're talking Land Rovers versus Jeeps.
Oh, yes, I know where you're going with this.
What about the sort of more upmarket SUV?
Yeah, well, the Range Rover's the first luxury SUV, isn't it?
No.
No, it's not.
Jeep Wagoneer?
Jeep Wagoneer. Jeep Super Wagoneer, I think you'll find.
Oh, well, Super Wagoneer.
Okay. So there was the Wagoneer in 62, but the posh one was a thing called the Super Wagoneer, which I think came out in 66. But whichever one you choose, they both predate the Range Rover, which went on sale in 70. Now, I don't think they were ever sold over here. Maybe this is quite a UK-centric or Euro-centric. Maybe somebody who listens to this in the US thinks, hang on, the Range Rover was never the first luxury SUV. We did it long before you. Maybe over there the perception is completely different. But certainly, you know, Range Rover just has this, you know, it created this entire category of cars, the luxury, and we just think, you know, it's almost a class in its own right, isn't it? It's almost like the Range Rover class, and it certainly was for a long time. But it certainly wasn't the first to do that job. I mean, and again, none of this is intended to in any way run down any of these cars, because I think an original Range Rover is a phenomenal piece of work. I think it is so cleverly conceived, and they understood the brief so well, but maybe they understood the brief so well because somebody else had already had a crack at it.
Good point. I think the thing about these cars that did or didn't create their sectors is that in the best cases, years later, they just seem bleedingly obvious, don't they? And, you know, an upmarket luxury 4x4 actually now seems bleeding obvious. But way back in the 60s, it wasn't clear. Yeah, or hot hatch. Yeah, of course. An affordable, sporty, but practical car that you can use every day. It seems
obvious. Why wouldn't that be a good idea?
Yeah. But it took someone with that insight, because back then it wasn't immediately obvious that people would bother paying extra money for a slightly hotted up hatchback.
And the Range Rover in particular, you think about that, you know, the ladder chassis and the live axles and all the things which made it good off-road. And someone come along thinking, well, we could take those things and somehow use them to a completely different purpose, a purpose to which they would appear to be diametrically opposed, but do it so well that you create an entire new category of car. I just think it's, because it might have not been easier, it would have certainly been more expensive, but the natural thing to have done back then, you know, even the 1970s, would have been to create, you know, a car with a monocoque chassis and conventional suspension, and just to, you know, apologise for the fact that it wasn't great off-road, but at least it had, you know, four-wheel drive and a bit of ground clearance. Didn't do that. They stayed true to their roots. They made it an off-roader first and a luxury car second, and have cashed in ever since.
Yeah, there is ingenuity in this, dreaming something up from nothing, and then bringing it to market successfully and convincing people that they need one.
Yes.
And that's actually as difficult as any of it, isn't it?
Well, can we go to another category of car which makes this point extremely well? First, the first mid-engined supercar.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah. Lovely. Now,
yeah, first mid-engined supercar I've really got was Lamborghini Miura. You know, 1966. Again, it just wasn't. But, I mean, I'm even going to have to look over here because I'm just trying to remember what its exact name is. The René Bonnet de Jet.
Yeah, the Jet, yeah. Apparently he put the D in front because he knew that French speakers and other romantic language speakers would call it a yet.
So how do you pronounce it then?
Jet.
Jet. So the D is
silent. I just read this. So I read this at some point. I can't remember when.
So should I be feeling a bit of a chump for just calling it a de jet?
Well, it is spelled de jet. So no, I don't think so. But apparently it is just jet because he didn't want people saying yet.
Him being René Bonnet, presumably not René Bonnet.
Well, Bonnet Jet. I mean, there we go.
Boringly, this car became a Matra, didn't it?
Yeah. So this is 1962, so it did predate the Miura by 4 years.
4 years
predated the Miura. But was it a supercar?
It was a mid-engine car. It was a mid-engine road car.
Yeah.
Forget the word supercar. Yeah, yeah. You know, okay, so it was still the first mid-engine road car. And yeah, the specification... Wishbones all round, disc brakes all round, 1962. 700 kilos?
That's pretty amazing,
I mean,
isn't it?
I just want to drive one. I mean, it might have been rubbish, I don't know, but, I mean, on paper, I mean, your 1962 mid-engine car, double wishbones all round, disc brakes, 700 kilos. It must have been amazing.
So I suppose the Miura does have a case that it was the first mid-engine supercar. Because I think the Jet was, you know, it wasn't enormously powerful, was it? So maybe it's better defined as a sports car.
Yeah, but even so,
but also,
know, it's 64, De Tomaso Vallelonga.
Okay.
That predates the Miura, and that was a supercar. Okay,
well,
it wasn't in production for very long, and it wasn't very good, but that's not what we're judging here, is it?
But this it feeds into what we were saying earlier, wasn't it? You don't have to be first to... be the one who makes a success of it. And Lamborghini maybe benefited from seeing what others had done.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Miura. Yeah, it's extraordinary what Lamborghini did with the Miura.
Given the resources at the time. And I think it also shows... It just shows foresight. Because someone's done it before, you know, Lamborghini could just as easily have looked at the René Bonnet Jet and probably even the Vallelonga and just gone, well, they didn't work. Yeah. Why would I do something like that? Yeah?
Yeah.
But he didn't do that. He just saw, well, racing cars have gone that way.
Mm.
That's the, you know, and whereas Ferrari were always so slow to respond to anything, you know, I think Lamborghini just saw that that's the way the river was flowing and thought, well, you know, we can either just, you know, wait and wait and wait. But, you know, he had a new company, didn't he? He had to do something. You know, Ferrari was so well established. And his first car, you know, had been well received, but it wasn't beautiful and it didn't exactly set the world on fire. And he needed something which would make people sit up and notice. And, you know, he took a very brave decision because previous attempts, as discussed, hadn't worked. And, you know, basically secured the future of his company.
Actually, it's a very good point. You could just dismiss an idea if it hadn't worked before and not think about it again.
Yeah.
So it does take some insight to clock, to recognise that little kernel of potential.
Yeah.
And think, I can I can make this work, even though others haven't done before.
Yeah, and I think that there is some relevance to the present day. I mean, you and I have both now driven the new GT3 RS 911, and I have thought for a long time, you know, what's going to be the next great area of development in road cars, because there's not really much point in giving them any more power, and you know, and their chassis are so good, but aero just seemed to be, you know, a completely neglected area. People just didn't, you know, and okay, there have been some incredibly esoteric cars like, you know, McLaren P1s and Sennas and that sort of thing, which have tried to do this. And I'm not saying for a moment that GT3 RS is mainstream, but it's a sight more mainstream than, you know, than a Senna or a P1. And I think that's where the world is going to go, where the sort of, you know, the top end sports car world is going to go. You're going to suddenly find things with huge amounts of downforce. Because, you know, that's what gives you the Nürburgring lap time. That's what gives you a really dramatic appearance. And I suspect, compared to any other route you go, it's probably not that expensive to do, because you're just adding stuff onto what's already there. And it doesn't require a huge number of moving parts and so on and so forth. So I think that Porsche have suddenly recognised that that's going to be the next. And it'd be very interesting to see, you know, what other manufacturers do. But I suspect that aero is going to be, you know, the next big thing among sporting car manufacturers, and we'll see cars with ever more of stuff, and, you know, that's the way it's going to go. But, you know, it's exactly the same with what Lamborghini was doing in the 60s, where they suddenly realised that the future of, you know, the top-end sports car was mid-engined. And they just reacted first to it.
And it's interesting that with this latest GT3 RS, Porsche has, close to doubled aerodynamic downforce over the previous car, just by... And actually, if you look at them side by side, they both look like they've got enormous rear wings, lots of vents and flicks all over the place. You wouldn't necessarily know, would you? But, yeah, so maybe downforce is what manufacturers are going to be bragging about on their sports cars from now.
And also, the other thing it does is the configurability. You know, just being able to sit there and, you know, set your diff settings and your damper, so your rebound and your bump and all that stuff, which I think for most people is just, I don't think that 99% of people will even bother with it. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because it's like, you know, 99% of people never drive their car at their top speed. It doesn't matter that you don't do it. It's that you know that it can, or that you could if you wanted to. And that's what it's all about. And so you are going to see people responding to that, and there will be absolutely ridiculous levels of configurability, which is, you know, which you can just sit there and just go on the dashboard, because again, I don't think it's very expensive to do, and it allows people to go, you know, oh look, I've just, you know, been able to, you know, add another click of rebound on the rear right, and that means my car's going to feel exactly the same. No, they don't say that, but
I tried to shed a little bit of light on all that, the GT3 RS's configurability, with a story. It's on the Appen website now, and a video that you can find on the Appen website and on YouTube, if you like. But yeah, it's interesting stuff. Okay, so let's... You've mentioned McLaren.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned a couple of hypercars.
Yeah.
So obviously, as we all know, the first hypercar was the McLaren F1, wasn't it? Everyone knows that. Maybe not then.
Well, I mean, it wasn't even the first carbon road car. You know, that's another claim that the McLaren has. It's the first road car with a carbon tub. I mean, this is a bit of a cheat.
I don't think
it is, actually. Jaguar XJR15.
Okay. So, yeah, a racing car made road legal, more or less.
It had a number plate. You know, it wasn't like a one-off. You know, there were road cars. It was sold as a road car. It had a carbon tub. Now, you may say there are only, I don't know how many, but maybe there are only 15 of them, but there are only 64 McLaren F1s. So...
Mm. Yeah, so why should the F1 get that credit?
Well, probably because it was fully homologated and everything else, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. But forgetting, and it was designed as a road car first, I suppose. Forgetting the carbon fibre thing, I mean, it probably wasn't the first hypercar, was it? I mean, it did do certain things. It elevated performance, particularly top speed, to a level far beyond what was offered before.
I've said this before, it expanded the envelope for road car performance by a greater margin than any car before or since. And that is its legacy. It was... Mm. Nothing took a greater step. But it wasn't... Okay, the first hypercar. I mean, you know, I would argue, what is a hypercar? I mean, it can't, you can't define it by power or speed, because obviously these things change over time. So a hypercar is, to me, an out and out sports car, which possesses more performance than anything else around at that time, made in incredibly small numbers and sold for a very high price. All of which
describes but also the using, to some extent, using new technologies,
innovative materials,
processes, and latest engineering. Yeah. That's got to be a part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. All of which describes the Ferrari 288 GTO.
Yeah, it does. And actually, Gavin Green wrote a piece for us recently, didn't he? And again, it's on the TI app and website now, making the case for the 288 GTO being the original hypercar. And it's a compelling case. But, you know, this is well beyond my area of expertise, but I'm sure there'd be people out there who could make a good case for there being pre-war stuff that fits into that category. But then it becomes very tricky to what's a supercar, what's a hypercar. Yeah. It just becomes such a grey area, doesn't it?
It is, and we shouldn't get bogged down in the semantics of it. You know, the thing is that you don't need a fixed definition from which there can be no variance, because there will always be exceptions and there will always be grey areas. All that matters is that we know it and we see it. If I say to you hypercar, you know, you're not thinking of a Ford Fiesta. You know exactly what I'm referring to. So does everybody else. But it's, I think, those components that you talk about, or, you know, that we're discussing, you know, the new level of performance, the use of, you know, previously untried technologies in that particular area, high price, low volume, all that sort of thing. They are all components of it, certainly.
So lots of the cars we've spoken about already have stolen the credit for being the first of their type, when actually they weren't really.
Yeah.
They were maybe just the first that made a success of it. But I think the Renault Espace probably is a good example of a car that is considered the first of its type and is.
Oh, I'm going to have to look it up. I don't think it was.
Really?
I think that there was a Chrysler minivan in the US.
Yeah, okay. Are they different? I suppose they're not really.
Well, no, something like an original Fiat Multipla. That was, you know, that had six seats, 600cc engine, but it had six seats. I mean, there were...
Original Fiat Multipla. I'm going to have to look this up now. That is a bizarre looking thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It looks like a big bubble car.
Well, I think that's almost exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to come up with another in a minute, which is going to absolutely, and you're going to have to look that up too, and people are going to get really cheesed off with us. Well, look up a 1936 Stout Scarab. That's the first MPV. 1936 Stout Scarab.
So did that go on sale though? Really?
Yeah, it did. It went on sale. That was on sale. It wasn't the Renault.
That is an
Espace.
Extraordinary looking car.
So, if you're in the highly likely event you're only listening to this rather than watching it, when you get home or out the bath or whatever it is you're doing, go and have a look at the 1936 Stout Scarab and then tell us it wasn't the first MPV.
There's nothing sacred. Okay, so the Espace. But the Espace did do something, though. What did it do?
Beaten by the Stout Scarab by nearly half a century.
Yeah, half a century. Okay, fine. But the Espace, maybe it took the MPV thing mainstream. It's interesting, yeah. Do you know what? I always assumed the Espace was the first MPV, but clearly it wasn't.
Okay. Was the Avon team the first two-door MPV?
Well, first and last.
The first and last.
That was a sector, a genre that nobody was asking for, wasn't it?
Well, exactly. So that doesn't actually count, because we're talking about sector-defining cars, and if you don't have a sector because you're the only car in it, then you automatically disqualify yourself.
Do we need to talk about the original Mini?
What was it first at? Or what is it known to be first at? It wasn't by a mile the first front-wheel drive car. You know, I own a front-wheel drive car that's older than a Mini. It wasn't the first truly compact runabout, because there were bubble cars. I mean, the Fiat 500 predates the Mini. I think what you could say was it was the first to really perfect front-wheel drive. Front-wheel drive cars, I mean, people forget, if they ever knew, that an Alvis came sixth at Le Mans in 1928 with front-wheel drive.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Okay. So people go, oh, yes, the Traction Avant was the first front-wheel drive car. No, it wasn't.
Hmm.
So there was an Alvis in the 1920s that they were doing it. But again, and that wasn't just a racing car. You know, they didn't make many, but they made about 150 of them, I think. So it's, you know, it's a proper thing. They're still knocking about today. Mm. I've completely forgotten what your question was. Oh, the Mini.
Well, no,
I was just making the point about front-wheel drive. I think what you can say about the Mini, and again, I might be wrong, but this is my understanding, it was the first one that really made front-wheel drive work. You go and drive my 2CV, as you will shortly, because we've got a plan for that car. We've got the most ridiculous twin test that's ever come up with. Plan for the next few weeks involving my 2CV and something else. What you'll notice is that because it's got universal joints at the front, when it goes around a corner, the tighter the corner, the more the steering tugs you at. It tugs and it tugs and it tugs. And Alec Issigonis wasn't going to put up with that. And so the constant velocity joint was developed. And it was the perfecting of the CV joint in the Mini, which took away the disadvantage of front-wheel drive and perfected it. And then after that, I think it was because of the massive packaging advantages. Because if you remember, you know, most small cars before that, you know, everything from, you know, the Fiat 500 to the Beetle, they're all rear engine, rear drive, because that was the only way that you could, you know, get enough space inside a car for people. And that was fraught with all sorts of problems, handling problems, crash problems, all those sorts of things. But Issigonis's genius of perfecting front-wheel drive and then putting the radiator down the side of the car rather than having it slung out in front created this packaging miracle. So it was the first to do that. But I think anything you have to sort of explain in that kind of detail almost sort of disqualifies it. You know, but yeah, first to perfect front-wheel drive.
So it's another good example of it wasn't the first car of its type. It wasn't the first mover in a sector, but it got it right. And actually, that basically describes almost all the cars we've been speaking about, even the Espace, I suppose. It was the first that got it right and made a commercial success of it. In so many cases, it's an obscure car that the vast majority of us have never heard of.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just how things work in the car sector.
Okay, can I talk about one car which was first to two things and hasn't had the credit for either? Jensen FF.
Yes.
Yeah?
So, hang on, four-wheel drive and ABS?
Correct. Yeah? Audi Quattro, first four-wheel drive sports car.
No.
Not even close. Not even close. Jensen FF did it in 1966. The W116 S-Class, about 1978, first car with anti-lock brakes. Again, no. I haven't driven an FF. If anybody listening to this knows someone who has one, I would love to drive, because I just want to see what... I mean, I think it was I think the ABS was a really clunky... It was Maxaret, they called it. It was a really clunky system, and I think it worked. And again, I'm old enough to remember the days of mechanical ABS, where essentially it wasn't an electronic system which detected... basically, it almost required a wheel to lock, which would then shut a valve, which would then release the pressure and allow it to roll again. So it was basically, I imagine it would have been, it would effectively allow the tire to get lock, unlock, you know, plenty of times. But it would have been, I imagine, quite limited in its function. But it was, you know, anti-lock braking.
I'm just beginning to think now that you don't, in the car sector at least, you do not want to be the first mover. There are very few examples of the first in a category then going on to get the credit and have all the glory and the success. Very few. Although, here's one. And, you know, we're getting recent now. And there are examples from the more recent times in the car sector because the technology is evolving quickly at the moment. So the first mass-produced hybrid vehicle, 1997.
Oh, but the Prius.
It's the obvious one, yeah, the Prius.
Yeah.
So it beat the Honda Insight by a couple of years.
And okay.
Even now, the Prius is recognised as being the original hybrid, isn't it? So that's an example.
So that's a real exception. First turbocharged car.
Was it the Oldsmobile?
Very good. because that's not what people think it is. People think it was, there's always this sort of coin toss between, was it the 2002 turbo BMW or was it the 911 turbo? Because both appeared, I don't think either went on sale, but both appeared in 1973. And of course, neither was the case. The Oldsmobile Jetfire. And I think was there also a Chevrolet equivalent of it? I think there was, but anyway. 10 years earlier, I think, 62, 63, had a... I mean, turbocharging had been around. It had been used in aircraft. One of my great automotive trivia facts is that pole position for the Indy 500 was taken in 1952 by a car that was not only turbocharged, but powered by diesel. Cummins diesel engine got pole position. So the Jetfire was, it had a 3.5 litre engine, had about 215 horsepower, which was punching in 1962. Understanding for the reason it didn't work is it required a strange brew of stuff. It had to run on not just petrol, but they had to stick distilled water in it and something else as well. Something like ether or ethanol or something like that. And people just couldn't be bothered. And so it died.
Yeah.
And it took another 10 years for... Well, go on.
Well, no, there's an example then of trying to embrace the technology too soon before it was ready. And the Germans didn't do it until it was ready and it could be used reliably and effectively and easily.
Yeah.
And away they went. Okay, what was the first car to make EV aspirational?
EV aspirational? Well, certainly wasn't the Nissan Leaf. I suppose not the Tesla Roadster. First car, well, it depends. I mean, again, aspirational is just one of those sort of, terms that anyone could describe in any number of different ways.
It's not very definite, is it?
Taycan?
Tesla Model S, surely.
Tesla Model S, yeah, okay.
2009?
No, you're right. You're right. Yes, you're absolutely right.
So that's... Yeah, that's a bit like the Prius, isn't it? It got there first and actually took the credit for it.
Except the Prius was a something. It was the first hybrid car. You know, you could point to components. An aspirational, it's a much more ephemeral concept, isn't it?
What about the first electric hypercar? So very up to date now. And I think it was the Rimac Concept 1. I don't think anything else on the road. Well, that's true, but they built eight of them. So it's super low volume, but they were out there and they sold them to customers. What's curious now, and it did spark a sector because there are now several electric hypercars on the market. The Nevera from Rimac, which was on Toggy the other day, wasn't it?
The Batista, the
Pininfarina, Avaya. Batista, the Lotus Avaya. What's curious about these is that nobody has triumphantly declared their limited run of electric hypercars all sold out yet, have they?
No.
And you know they would.
They would be shouting it from the treetops. And so the only thing you can conclude from that is that they haven't sold out. I remain very... What's the word? I remain to be convinced that, we mustn't go on too long about electric hypercars because, to an extent, who cares? But I just don't think that those sorts of cars are going to capture the emotions in the way that, what Aston Martin are doing or Gordon Murray is doing or any of the other hypercars that we know. Because, to me, there has to be an emotional connection with those cars because just the fact that they're really fast just isn't enough. But maybe I'm wrong.
I actually think they'll find an audience among a different group of people. I think it'll be tech people, people who actually are not interested in conventional supercars or hypercars, but because it's electric, because of the technology involved, they find it interesting. I think that's how they will find their audience, if indeed they do. So I think we've dispelled a few myths there. Maybe I've learnt a few things, notably the Espace. I was convinced that was the first MPV. But actually, when you look back, what was it? The Scarab. That is...
The Stout Scarab. Or was it the Scarab Stout? No, it was the Stout Scarab.
Yeah, you can't say that's not an MPV. So what have we learned then? You don't want to be the first mover.
No, absolutely not. To come first, come second.
That is the truth of it, isn't it?
To be remembered as the first, make sure you're the second.
Yeah. So maybe that's what we need to do. We need to look at who's trying to pioneer an interesting new technology and then just get their second.
Yeah, and wait for them to completely stuff it up and then pounce. Yeah.
And make sure it has oval windows rather than square windows.
Yes, exactly. Got to read a question for me.
We've got it's a listener question. And
reader, listener.
Yeah, that is coming up. Before we do that, thank you everybody for listening to the podcast. Thank you for rating and reviewing the podcast. It's important that you keep doing that because that's how we find a new audience. Also, most of you will not be subscribed to the podcast wherever you listen to it, whether that's the Apple app or Spotify. So please hit the subscribe or follow button. And that just helps us find a bigger audience, basically. So do it. It takes a moment of your time and it really makes a difference. So the listener question, and I'm afraid I've screenshotted this question and managed to crop out the name of the person asking it. So I'm afraid I don't have your name, but hopefully you'll recognise the question. Which car company executive do you think has had the biggest impact on the industry or the company they have worked for? These are the titans of the industry that we're thinking about. And I think we can ignore the founders because obviously it's
Ford. So we can't have Enzo or Henry Ford?
No, we can't. We can't have Ferruccio. But who are the executives, the suits, the bosses who have really left the mark or turned around their companies? And I think some have actually legitimately saved their companies, like Carlos Ghosn, saving Nissan. Tavares, yeah, and creating new alliances, particularly in the case of Ghosn, Renault, Nissan, Mitsubishi. But what about the likes of Ferdinand Piëch, who
absolutely
left his mark on Volkswagen?
Yeah.
He was an engineer rather than an executive, really, wasn't he? He certainly was.
First. Well, he was pitched on gang. Luca. I mean, if you look at what Luca did for the Ferrari Formula One team in the 1970s, and then the basket case he inherited when he came back in the early 1990s, and what he turned that company into. De Montezemolo is the bloke. I mean, I just love the bloke. I just think he is such an impressive, admirable, clear-sighted, properly motivated bloke. He's probably, certainly of the sort of car brands that I know about and are close to my heart. You know, I think he's the person who just understood what was going wrong and just turned a company that was living on its laurels, had become complacent and arrogant, and just turned it into, you know, we all go on today, don't we, about how amazingly well Ferraris are engineered. But that culture of excellence actually was instilled by Luca, because the cars that came before his time, I mean, you know, the cars of the 50s and the 60s, they were wonderful cars in their own way. They looked beautiful and they were, they had amazing engines and they went faster than anything else, but they didn't have that across the board. There's those incredible standards and Luca who did that. So for me, it would be him.
There must be some designers as well who have done an enormous amount to turn around the fortunes of the company they've been employed by. I think even our mate Ian Callum deserves credit there.
Yeah, Ian Callum and Julian Thompson, you know, two of our contributors. You know, look what Ian did first for Aston Martin and then for Jaguar. Mm. And you look at, you know, what Julian did for Lotus. And although, you know, somebody else took the credit, you know, when he designed the LRX, the Land Rover LRX, which got turned into the Evoque, he created a design language for Land Rover and therefore Range Rover, which is dining out on to this day. I mean, you know, these are absolutely game-changing designs. By game-changing, you know, I don't mean that, you know, they were among the prettiest cars of their time. They changed the fortunes of their companies. You know, where would Lotus be without the Elise? Where would Range Rover be without the Evoque?
And that's right, and particularly in the case of Aston Martin, the DB7, you can recognise that as an Aston Martin even now. You see in, say, the current DBS Superleggera, how that has evolved from the basic design language of the DB7. It's really significant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you for your question. I'm sorry I didn't make a note of your name, but appreciate your question. And do get your listener questions across. So you can email us, info@the-intercooler.com, or send us a message on Twitter or Instagram. I do see them. And we'll end next week's podcast with a note.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.